Dear Brother Young, I'm indeed very happy to be with you, dear friends. I've already been richly blessed at this convention, and I am commissioned to bring to you the Christian love and greetings of our home class, Paterson, New Jersey, and even more especially of my wife, and Tom and Ruth. The mystery to the Gentiles. As you might have assumed, our text is Romans 11:25. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Friends, we believe that this is a very important subject. In fact, while we're not dogmatic on this, we may be wrong, but I think wrong if we get too far out of line on this subject. We just might miss out on a little block. That'll be pretty serious, wouldn't it? As I say, I'm not dogmatic on this, but I just want to alert you to the fact that I consider this very important, and if you go along with what the scriptures and the pastor have to say on this, I think you'll conclude that it's quite important, too. Now, the Lord has not predestined individuals, but he has predetermined certain qualifications for the little flock, the bride of Christ. For those whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. Now, that is predetermined. And the Apostle Paul, a little later on in the same chapter, seems to mention another predetermined qualification for those who are to be associated with Christ. He says in verses 30 and 32, "For as ye in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy." Now, I think this, the blessing of Israel is the first thing on the agenda. A new order is established. Don't you think it's important, then, that we should be reconciled with the ways of the Lord in this matter? Now, first of all, I think it's proper that we should recognize that there was a mystery to the Jews in the first place. Paul calls this to our attention in Ephesians, the third chapter, verses 3 to 6. "How that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, as I wrote afore in few words, whereby when he read, ye may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, as it is now revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs." Now, this is a mystery. It was been a mystery to the Jews all down through the ages. But finally, this mystery was cleared up as far as the Jews were concerned. And what was the mystery to them? That the Gentiles should be fellow heirs and of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ by the gospel. That then was the mystery to the Jews. This is confirmed in Colossians, the first chapter, verse 25-28, which we won't take time to read. But we wish you would make notes, and that'll save us a lot of time in reading some of these references. So now we turn to Acts the 15th chapter, to find out just how and under what circumstances this mystery was cleared up to the Jews. You remember that this problem of the salvation of the Gentiles and the restrictions and instructions imposed upon them was a matter of deep concern to the early church. So much so that the leaders called a conference on this subject. Now, this is recorded for us in the 15th chapter of Acts, and we begin reading with the 6th verse. "And the apostles and elders came together for to consider this matter. And when there had been much disputing," they had some hot discussions back there too. You know, there's nothing more important to a Christian than the religion, truth. Why, many Christians now compliment themselves. They say, "We are so much, have so much more love than our forefathers. They fought over religion. They even split up," and so on. So they take that as a mark of love, you see. And yet you cross one of these, you tell them that if he's a Republican, you tell them that the Democrats are the best party, you have a fight on your hands. Or maybe if you're driving a Chevrolet and he's driving a Ford, and you try to tell them that a Chevrolet is better than a Ford, you have a fight on your hands. They'll fight about these little things. Now, what does this imply? It implies that religion doesn't make as much difference to them as what political party you belong to, or what car you drive, even. That isn't a good sign at all when people aren't concerned about religious differences. "And when there had been much disputing, Peter rose up and said unto them, Men and brethren, ye know how that a good while ago God made choice among us that the Gentiles, by my mouth, should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And God, which knoweth the hearts, bear them witness, giving them the Holy Spirit, even as he did unto us. And put no difference between us and them, purifying their hearts by faith." And then a little farther over, James puts this all together. You know, there's a wonderful statement of the progression of God's plan. Verses 13 to 17, which are also familiar to us. "And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, Men and brethren, hearken unto me. Simeon," that is Peter, "hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles, to take out of them a people for his name. And to this agree the words of the apostles, the prophets, as it is written." After this, after the people for his name has been taken out from the Gentiles, "after this I will return, will build again the tabernacle of David which has fallen down, and I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles now, not just the few that are called to be the bride, all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, to do with these things." Then this mystery to the Jews was resolved at this conference. Now, wouldn't it be reasonable, after all God says, come, let us reason together, we find the plan of God is both scriptural and it's reasonable. Now, if this reluctance on the part of the Jews to accept the Gentiles was a mystery to the Jews, wouldn't it be reasonable to think that the mystery to the Gentiles would be in the opposite direction? That is, the reluctance of Gentiles to recognize the full inheritance of Israel. We think that's a reasonable proposition. What then is this mystery? Blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Now, is there any Christian denomination you know of that doesn't realize that Israel has been cast off? Everybody recognizes that. That isn't the mystery. What then is the mystery? We'll you make a long story of this, but we'll have to make it short. The mystery is just exactly what Paul says, that it's only a partial blindness. That is, they're not blind to the prophets. They're not blind to a lot of things about the religion. They're blind to this one spot, you know. And also, not all of them are blinded. It's a partial blindness in that respect, too. So it's only a partial blindness, but more importantly, for a limited time. Isn't that exactly what he says? The blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. After which, he shows in this chapter, they will be restored to their former favor and glory. He says, have they stumbled that they should fall? Well, practically everybody says, sure, they stumbled right out. That isn't what Paul says. They haven't stumbled that they should fall. But they stumbled, you see, long enough for the Gentile believers to sweep in ahead of them to get to the, fill up the balance of spiritual Israel. Then they'll recover from that stumbling and they'll run along just as though they'd never stumbled. That's what it implies. And that's what we hope to prove. If they're going to come back. In other words, the gospel age is nothing but a parenthesis between the old law covenant and the new law covenant. And it isn't a new law covenant with anybody but the ones that have the old law, obviously. Otherwise you wouldn't designate new law. We may come to that if we have time. I would like to turn your attention to a remarkable pair of twins. We got a lot to learn from these twins. In Genesis, the 27th chapter, we read about the blessings which were given to Jacob and Esau. And the 38th verse of the 27th chapter, we read, and Esau said unto his father, hast thou but one blessing, my father? You know how most people answer, yes, there's just one blessing, that's all. Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Well, we don't have to guess about this. The Apostle Paul, on the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, recorded in Hebrews 11th chapter in the 20th verse, recounting the faith exploits of these wonderful ancient worthies, he says, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. Now, we got to believe it. That's what the Lord is telling us. And, of course, Jacob represents spiritual Israel, and Esau represents fleshly Israel. They were twins. The Jewish age and the gospel age are parallel dispensations. They're twins. And the one that had the highest position was brought forth last, Jacob. Remarkable picture, and you can't ask for a more authentic type. Inasmuch as Isaac represents Christ, and Rebekah would represent the bride. And then in the next generation, you have Jacob and Esau. There you have Jacob representing spiritual Israel, Esau representing fleshly Israel. And I think most Bible scholars would agree on this point. And certainly Bible students would have to agree. That they did represent those two classes. Now we read in verses 28 and 29 about the blessing to Jacob. Therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be every one that curseth thee and blessed is he that blesseth thee. Now that was a blessing to Jacob. But Paul tells us that Isaac blessed Esau too. And so we find it, that there was a blessing to Esau. These are recorded in verses 39 and 40. And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, that is when Esau said, hast thou but one blessing to give? And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven from above. Now, that is really all that Esau ever wanted, wasn't it? He wanted the good things of this life, this earth. And the blessing to Esau assures him of that very thing, although he did miss what would have been an even higher position in the spiritual realm, the spiritual part of the kingdom. Now, coming over to the 32nd chapter, we read about the return of Jacob. You know, the Lord instructed him to go back to the promised land, but he was still fearful of Esau. And he was reluctant to do that, but the Lord knew how to handle this proposition. And he instructed Jacob to send presents ahead to Esau. Well, these were some valuable presents. The context shows that the amount totaled 580 animals, that by which wealth was determined in those days, was the extent of their herds. And he gave Esau 580 animals. Now, this, of course, placated Esau. When Jacob, he abandoned the entire wealth of his father Isaac to Esau when he fled. So Esau knew that Jacob knew that Esau was a very rich man. And if now he was super adding 580 animals in these three flocks, why, Esau reasoned, well, Jacob must be fabulously rich, which he was. Right? And he isn't coming back to claim any of Isaac's possessions, even though he was entitled to it. You see? Moreover, notice the way Esau expressed this. This is quite remarkable. He wasn't coming back to lord it over him. In the 33rd chapter and the 4th verse. 32nd chapter, verses 17 to 20. And he commanded the foremost, that is the first of these herds, saying, when Esau, my brother, meeteth thee, and asketh thee, saying, whose art thou, and whither goest thou, and whose are these before thee, then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob. Notice that, servant Jacob, not his lord, not Lord Jacob, which he had been constituted. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau, and behold, also he is behind us. And so he commanded the second and the third to do likewise. So Esau had the assurance in advance that Jacob was not coming back to lord it over him. And you know, I think this is very significant, that Jacob caught the spirit of the new commandment which the Lord later gave to spiritual Israel, his disciples. He says among the Gentiles they would lord it over their subjects, but it shall not be so among you. Let him that is chief among you, let him be your servant. This then is in keeping with the spirit of rulership which the Lord gives. And it was exemplified here, we think, in Jacob. Now, just to show how completely satisfied Esau was, notice verses 8 to 11. And he said, what meanest thou by all this drove? They ought to miss the meeting of Jacob and Esau. That's a remarkable thing. Recorded in the 4th verse of the 33rd chapter. And Esau ran to meet him, and embraced him, and fell on his neck, and kissed him, and they wept. I submit that that shows the proper attitude and relationship between spiritual and fleshly Israel. Verses 8 to 11. And he, that is Esau, said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother, keep that thou hast unto thyself. He refused at once, but not twice. And Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and he took it. And in that very act, Jacob became the benefactor of Esau. The acceptance of this. Remember when the king of Sodom wanted to reimburse Abraham for assisting in, or for defeating the enemy? Abraham said no. He says, I want to accept it, lest they say that the king of Sodom made Abraham rich. You see the difference? Abraham is not a beneficiary of Sodom. But Esau became the beneficiary of Jacob. Now think of this. Not only did Jacob leave to Esau all of the physical assets of his father Isaac, which was a rich inheritance, but he even super added 580 animals in these three flocks. Now, I can't reconcile that with the idea of being stingy with natural Israel. When we have gotten from them the exceedingly greater riches of the eye-calling privilege, which we wouldn't have had had they all accepted. I think that was shown yesterday. If the ones that had been bidden to the feast had come, there wouldn't have been any call out in the highways and beyond the hedges. I don't find it in my heart to begrudge the blessings that Israel is going to receive. They both were fabulously rich, as shown in the 36th chapter, verses 6 to 8. And Esau took his wives and his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his house, and his cattle, and all his beasts, and all his substance, which he had got in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. Why? For their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them, because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. They were both fabulously rich. And so it will be. Both spiritual and fleshly Israel will be fabulously rich in the new order. There is evidence, of course, more pronounced now, certainly, than in the pastor's day, and yet he could see that this was coming. And you know, that's one of the saddest experiences I've had, to see this wonderful legacy that the pastor left us on this subject just frittered away until we practically have nothing left. Some. Sad. It could have serious consequences that I've already intimated. I don't know. I'm not saying definitely. No, it doesn't mean second death. They're not talking about that at all. It could mean the difference between the bride and the bridesmaids, though, like a spelling contest. I have a brother often tell me, well, are these things so important? Is it a life and death matter? I assure them, why, no, I don't think it's a life and death matter at all. I don't think there are many that are going to the second death in the first place. And certainly the differences amongst us, even though they may be numerous, they're not that serious. It doesn't involve denying the ransom. Well, it doesn't mean second death. But it could mean great company. Now, I use this illustration of a spelling contest. You have to be a good speller to even get in the contest. And so be either the wise or foolish virgins, you've got to be of the virgin class, pure in heart, you see. But then the contest begins, starting out with relatively easy words, and they're spelled down one after another. And before the contest is over, almost invariably, they get into words that you would probably never use in all your life. You may never even see them again or hear of them. But it's legitimate for showing the difference between those that have applied themselves and those that have been careless. That's exactly what it says. That's what the Apostle Paul says. I see here there are heresies among you. There must have needs be heresies that the approved might be made manifest. So those that are spelled down would be the great company class, you see. So let's watch these difficult words, you see. They might be very important in the final contest. Now, in the 15th chapter of Genesis, we have the identification of the branch of Abraham's descendants that was to inherit the promises and to inherit the land. Now, following the Six-Day War, when Russia had been humiliated by the defeat of her allies, when she had lost $2 billion of modern war equipment, and she was smarting under that, she called a meeting of the Security Council and hoped to get judgment against Israel as an aggressor. Well, the United States vetoed that, so that didn't. But then she went confidently into the General Assembly, thinking certainly those little nations, for their own protection, would condemn Israel for aggression. But you know what happened? It was really amazing to follow that. Well, right in the midst of that, I called the Israeli consulate. I had been over there and was acquainted with some of them. And I told them I want to assure you that there are non-Jews who are sympathetic with the cause of Israel. And I said, I have something very important that I think is very important in this discussion with the Christian nations in order to gain their support or neutralize them anyway. And I told them that I'm not presuming to tell you what's in the Hebrew Bibles, although you know the Bibles are all about the same. But I'd like to emphasize what's in the Christian Bible and what the Christians, all Christians, claim to believe. They believe the Old Testament scriptures as well as the New, you know. And I said that if I could tell you something that should rally the Christian nations to the support of Israel and their right to a homeland over there, don't you think that's important? Well, the secretary said it certainly would be. Now, I read this passage I'm going to read here, the 15th chapter of Genesis, and verses 13 to 16. And these verses are in all the Bibles. And Abraham, and he said unto Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. Now, incidentally, the context here is very interesting. It even mentions the offering when Abraham asked, Lord, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And then you remember he told him to offer the sacrifices. And the aggregate ages of these animals was 11 years. Now, if you look in your Berean Comment Bible, you'll see that the suggestion is made there that 11 symbolic years bridges the gap, the period of time from that promise that was made to Abraham down until 1915, the end of the Gentile times. And incidentally, the war that began then was a means of liberating Palestine from the control of the implacable Turks. As long as the Turks had control, why, not even the Arabs had a look in over there, let alone the Jews. And World War, while the tension was riveted on the Western Front, and that terrible carnage there, the slaughter of all those men, the desecrating of all that land, plowing it up literally with shells. While all the attention was there, the important things evidently was going on in the Middle East. For General Allenby marched on from one victory to another, captured Jerusalem at Christmas time, 1917, marched on following many times the route that was taken by David and others in the conquest of their enemies. And just as they had driven the Turks, General Allenby, just as he had driven them across the old Solomon Davidic border of Israel, the farthest extent of Israel in their heyday, the war ended. I think that's the only constructive thing that came out of World War I, was the freeing of Palestine from the Turk. Well, England had her own designs on that territory, you know, but the Lord overruled it otherwise. So even though she was, tried to turn it over to the Arabs, the Lord overruled that, and Israel was reborn. Well, anyway, I think 1914 was important in that sense, because the mark of disfavor to the Gentiles would be a mark of corresponding favor to the Jews. Actually, there are only the two alternatives. Originally, it was the times of Israel, right? Then it was the times of the Gentiles. Well, when the times of the Gentiles end, then what? Why, it would revert to the times of Israel again. Just that simple, as I see it. There's every evidence that that's what's happening. Of course, Israel is going to share these blessings. Don't get the wrong idea. Now, of course, people get hung up on this matter of Jacob obtaining the blessing from Esau. In the first place, let's not get the idea that we have to condone or excuse what happened in Old Testament times. The light wasn't shining that bright. The path of the just, not only doctrine, but also a course of life. We can't expect to live down to Old Testament standards, set aside the New Testament specific instructions on the same subjects. So we don't have to excuse what happened back there. God winked at the ignorance in those times, but not now. But anyway, Esau had forfeited his right to those blessings to carry on the faith line before he sold the birthright. I think that's an important thing to consider. Because in the 26th chapter of Genesis, verses 34 and 35, it shows how that Esau went out and picked up a couple of the women of the land as wives. Now think of it. He had the example, of course, of Abraham before him. And he had the striking example of Abraham's concern lest Isaac should do that very thing. And he sent Eliezer way back to his own people to select a bride for Isaac. Now, in full knowledge of all that, Esau should have learned something. But he didn't have regard for that. He went out, picked up a couple of the wicked women of the land as wives. And it almost broke Rebekah's heart, as well as Isaac, particularly Rebekah. And she was concerned lest Jacob should do the same thing. Now, why was she so much more concerned about Jacob? And remember, the Lord, this is recorded in Genesis 27:46, and also 28 verses 1 and 2. She intimated that if Jacob went out and did follow Esau's example, that she would have no cause to live. Why did she feel so strongly about this and express herself? Because the Bible says that before the twins were born, God had indicated to her that the elder should serve the younger. Now, I wonder if she even mentioned this to Isaac. You know, it didn't count too much then. It was the father that was to determine what the blessings were and apportion the blessings on the basis of the firstborn. And after all, Esau was a man's man. And so he favored Esau. And Rebekah knew that Jacob was God's favorite. She might have mentioned it to Isaac. But even if she did, I doubt if Isaac would have paid much attention to it. He said, in your condition, you were having, you know, hallucinations or dreams and so on. You know, we can't pay any sense to that. So she had to contrive a way, according to Old Testament standards again, we're talking about that, so that God's will would be accomplished, to override Esau's preference, or Isaac's preference. Well, anyway, we know the story of how Jacob went back to Laban, and he got a wife from from this faith seed. See, that's a very important thing. When Esau married these wicked women of the land, he broke that line of the faith seed, which was so important. That's why God forbid the Israelites to intermarry. He had found this man, this family of this intense faith in Abraham. And there's something to this law of heredity, you know. Remember Timothy mentioned, or Paul mentions that concerning Timothy, that he had in 1 Timothy 1:5, 2 Timothy 1:5, that he saw this faith in, he saw the faith which was in his grandmother Lois and in his mother Eunice, and I perceive that it is in thee also. Now, do you think that was just by accident, or was it related to this law of heredity? Well, I think we would agree to the latter thought. So when Esau intermarried with these wicked people of the land, and they were wicked, he forfeited his right there, without any regard to the birth, to the selling of the birthright. Now, people, you see, have got hung up on that. And they point that out, even in modern times. That we should, of all people, we should understand that about our twin brother. Now, Jacob represents spiritual Israel, Esau represents fleshly Israel, and the two were twins, and one was as much a child of Abraham or Isaac as the other. Now the after Esau saw how this had displeased his parents, he married Mahala, the daughter of Esau, or of Ishmael, rather. Well, that didn't improve matters too much either, did it? Because Ishmael had not been of the faith seed of Abraham and had not inherited the blessing. Now, this shows then why God did the right thing when he selected Jacob. Now, in Exodus 34, verses 10 to 14, God gave instructions to Israel to cast out six nations before them, to destroy their idols and break down their altars, and to establish the worship of the true God. Now, he commissioned them to do that. Now, here people get hung up again. They say, look at the history of the Jews. When they went into the land, they destroyed those nations completely, annihilated them. Now they come over here again, and they want to do the same thing. And people fall for that. And Christian people fall for that. And Bible students fall for that. That line of propaganda that's going around. They don't understand these things. These nations were so wicked that the language describing their wickedness is too indelicate to even read from this platform. I'll cite the passages, and when you feel you've got a good, strong stomach and you still want to read it, you can do so. But the wickedness was so great. It's recorded in Leviticus, the 18th chapter, verses 24 to 28. The context is not recommended reading. Leviticus 20, verses 23 and 24. But the context there is in the same category. Now, these were the conditions that existed among those nations. Now, they were as bad as Sodom and Gomorrah. God could have wiped out those nations and been justified in doing it, and it would have been for their good. But that wouldn't have been so practical with it's all right for a city, you see. But to devastate and depopulate a whole rural area is something different. It would go to weeds, and the animals would take control. And that's exactly what God says. That's why he told Israel to go in gradually and subdue the land and take it over from the erstwhile rulers. Now, this is shown in Deuteronomy 7, 22 and 23. And then, of course, he adds a significant note. The Deuteronomy 9, verses 4 and 5, he says, it's not because you are so righteous that I'm doing this, but because these other nations are so wicked, by contrast. That's why he was giving them this land, and why he held them under pretty strict discipline, too. Now, Paul, in Romans, the 4th chapter and the 16th verse, makes a very significant statement. We're apt to miss it, I think, unless we are aware of these things. Romans 4:16. He says that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to that which is of the law, but also that which is of the faith of Abraham. Now notice the phraseology there. Is it the foregone conclusion in the early church that natural Israel was in the picture? Spiritual Israel was on the outside looking in. Everybody knew that fleshly Israel was to inherit certain rich promises. And unless we understand this change that's taken place, it's hard to understand some of the things the Apostle Paul has to say on this subject. He had to deflate this idea as far as the natural Israel was concerned, show that they weren't the real Israelites. They were Israelites, all right. But they weren't Israelites indeed. That's the point he's making. So in Romans 4:16, he says, the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only that which is of the law. Now analyze that, and you see that that's the point. It's a foregone conclusion that especially Israel was to have those blessings. Romans, the 9th chapter, verses 3 to 5, and 6 and 7. It says, for I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ, for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites. That isn't a question. That seems to be a question now. Who are Israelites? It wasn't a question in the Apostle Paul's mind. This is a declarative sentence. My brethren according to the flesh, my kinsmen, who are Israelites? Now that should settle this matter once and for all, whether the unbelieving Jewish nation are Israelites or not. And then he goes on to show the priority of spiritual Israel. And he gets down to Rebekah, and he mentions how that God had indicated to her that the elder should serve the younger. Now, could anyone deny that Esau was the legitimate son of Isaac? Without casting aspersions on his brother Jacob? You see the point? There's no question of what they're all Israelites. But one has priority over the other. That's the point. And they're both going to be fabulously rich, as we've already noted. Now, the whole 11th chapter of Romans is on this subject, to show that Israel has not been cast off. And it's in this chapter that we find our text. Now, a question comes up, and this has really bowled over a lot of the brethren. They say it was Israel in the type. How could it be Israel in the antitype? Some of them say, oh, I never thought of that. It couldn't be Israel. The antitype must be different or bigger, you see. Let's analyze it this way. The priests represented the entire church. They were Jews. They represented the entire church, Jew and Gentile, right? But that didn't preclude the fact that all of the apostles are Jews. I wonder if somebody will start complaining about that sometime. Even though the priests represented the complete church, Jew and Gentile, the prominent positions and the first positions are occupied by Jews. Now, if we follow the pattern then, Israel does represent the whole world of mankind. But it certainly doesn't rule out the thought that fleshly Israel will be the most prominent In fact, it would indicate that they would be the most prominent if we follow the logical conclusion. Now, this matter of accepting Israel should have been decided when we consecrated. God's people should become our people. And, you know, another thing, Satan knows who Israel is. He's demonstrated in his attempts to wipe them out as a people. Israel has served a long, just sentence. And when anyone has served their sentence, they are free. Now, let's recognize that. Of all people, let's recognize that they've served their time and they're due to be accepted back. If fleshly Israel lost the spiritual favors as well as the spiritual, then they've suffered double jeopardy. It is something that is frowned upon by any civilized nation in the world today. If you want a clincher point in the matter of God's acceptance of Israel and bringing her into a covenant relationship again, I just want to have you be sure to look up two scriptures. Ezekiel, the 16th chapter, verses 2, 58, and 60. And the chapter shows how unfaithful Israel has been, his unfaithful wife, and yet he says he's going to remember her as in the days of her youth, and he's going to bring her into the covenant. The same thing in Hosea, the 2nd chapter, verses 13 to 15 and 19 to 20. He expected a lot of some of his prophets. He asked Hosea to go out and marry a disreputable woman as a picture to the nation of Israel of what God was putting up with Israel. And yet he says in, read this, Hosea 2, 13 to 15, and particularly 19 to 20, he says he's going to remarry her. Now, I don't think anything can be plainer or comprehensive than that. Incidentally, I have papers here on what the Bible has to say on the subject. I also have some good excerpts from Brother Russell. And, of course, as usual, he's right on the beam on this subject. And so I have a few extra copies of at least one of these. So if you want to pursue this study, well, I'd be glad to give you a copy. Lord have
mercy. Well, dear friends, we're all richly indebted to our dear brother Leon Norby for his views on Israel, the most interesting people, nation ever born in the face of the earth because they were God's chosen people. Let us all stand, dear friends. We will sing one verse of hymn number 133, Home of the Soul. Let us stand. The first verse, 133. Brother Norby will then close this service, and he will ask the blessings upon the next service. 133, the first verse.
Loving Father in heaven, we are assured that unless the Lord build a house, they labor in vain who build it. We lay a claim upon this promise and ask thy blessing upon our dear brother as he ministers to us. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.